Chapter 35. Early Morning Sunshine. News of Siddhartha's return spread quickly throughout the rest of Kapilavatthu, confirmed by the serene presence of the bhikkhus begging every morning in the city. Many families made food offerings and were eager to hear the bhikkhus speak about the teaching. King Suddhodana asked the people to decorate the city streets with banners and flowers in preparation for the day the Buddha and the bhikkhus were invited to eat at the palace. He also lost no time in having small huts built in Nigrodha Park for the Buddha and his senior students. Many people came to the park to meet the bhikkhus. The people were impressed to see the former prince calmly begging in the city. The Buddha's return became the main topic of conversation among all the townspeople. Gotami and Yasodhara wanted to visit the Buddha at Nigrodha Park, but they were too busy that first week preparing for the reception of the Sangha. The king wanted to invite several thousand guests, including all the members of the government, as well as all those in the city who held other political, cultural, and religious positions. He ordered that all dishes for the meal be vegetarian. Prince Nanda, however, did find the time to visit the Buddha twice that week. He listened as the Buddha explained the path of awakening to him. Nanda loved and respected his elder brother, and he felt himself being drawn to the peaceful life of a bhikkhu. He even asked the Buddha whether or not he thought he would make a good bhikkhu, but the Buddha only smiled. He could see that although Nanda was a young man of admirable feelings and good intentions, he did not yet possess a strong sense of purpose or commitment. When he sat with the Buddha, Nanda wanted to become a monk, but when he returned to the palace, he had eyes and thoughts only for his lovely fiancée, Kalyani. Nanda wondered what the Buddha thought about his equivocation. The day for the reception arrived. The entire city, including the royal palace, was decked with banners and flowers to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha. The city bustled with excitement as the entire population formally welcomed home their heroic countrymen. Musicians played beautifully as crowds lined the streets. Everyone strained to catch a glimpse of the Buddha. Gotami and Yasodhara personally welcomed all the guests that had been invited by the king. Gopa had even given in to the queen's wishes that she dress in an elegant sari and wear jewels in honor of the occasion. The Buddha and the bhikkhus walked with slow, calm steps between the crowds. Many people joined their palms and bowed as the Buddha passed. Children were lifted onto their parents' shoulders so they could see. Happy shouts and applause rose from the crowds. The bhikkhus continued to follow their breath mindfully in the midst of the bustling, festive atmosphere. King Suddhodana greeted the Buddha and his Sangha at the outer gates of the palace. He led them to the inner courtyard. All the guests followed the king's example in joining their palms and bowing deeply to the Buddha, even though some of them wondered why it was necessary to show such great respect to a monk so young, even if he was the former prince. After the Buddha and the bhikkhus were seated, the king motioned to the servants to bring out the food. He himself served the Buddha. Yasodhara and Gotami directed the serving of all the other guests, which included Brahmins, ascetics, and hermits. Everyone ate in silence, following the example of the Buddha and his bhikkhus. When all the bhikkhus and all the guests were finished eating, and the bhikkhus' bowls had been washed and returned, the king stood and joined his palms. He invited the Buddha to teach the Dharma to all those gathered. The Buddha sat quietly for a moment in order to gain a sense of those present. He began by briefly recounting his experiences and seeking the way, as he knew the people were anxious to hear what had happened to him in the past 7 years. He spoke to them about the nature of impermanence, the absence of a separate self, and the law of dependent co-arising. He said that practicing awareness in daily life and looking deeply into things led to the cessation of suffering and the realization of peace and joy. He said that offerings and prayers were not effective means to attain liberation. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths: the existence of suffering, the causes of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. He said, in addition to the sufferings of birth, old age, sickness, and death, human beings endure other sufferings, which they themselves create. Out of ignorance and false views, people say and do things that create suffering for themselves and others. Anger, hatred, suspicion, jealousy, and frustration cause suffering. All these arise from lack of awareness. People are caught in their suffering as if they were caught in a house on fire, and most of our suffering we create ourselves. You cannot find freedom by praying to some god. You must look deeply into your own mind and situation in order to uproot the false views that are the root of suffering. You must find the source of your suffering in order to understand the nature of suffering. Once you understand the nature of suffering, it can no longer bind you. If someone is angry at you, you can get angry back at him, but that only creates more suffering. If you follow the way of awareness, you will not react with anger. Instead, you will quiet your mind in order to discover why that person is angry at you. By looking deeply, you can uncover the causes that led to the person's anger. If you see that you bear responsibility for angering the person, you will not become angry, but you will accept that your own misconduct has contributed towards his anger's creation. If you are without blame, you can try to see why the person has misunderstood you. Then you can find a way to help him understand your true intentions. In this way, you will avoid causing more suffering to both yourself and the other person. Your Majesty and honored guests, all suffering can be overcome by looking deeply into things. On the path of awareness, we learn to follow our breath to maintain mindfulness. We follow the precepts in order to build concentration and attain understanding. The precepts are principles of living which foster peace and joy. Practicing the precepts, our ability to concentrate develops, and we are able to live with greater awareness and mindfulness. Mindfulness nurtures the capacity to illuminate the true nature of our mind and our environment. With that illumination comes understanding. Only with understanding can we love. All suffering is overcome when we attain understanding. The path of true liberation is the path of understanding. Understanding is prajna. Such understanding can only come from looking deeply into the true nature of things. The path of precepts, concentration, and understanding is the path that leads to liberation. The Buddha paused for a moment and then smiled before continuing to speak. But suffering is only one face of life. Life has another face, the face of wonder. If we can see that face of life, we will have happiness, peace, and joy. When our hearts are unfettered, we can make direct contact with the wonders of life. When we have truly grasped the truths of impermanence, emptiness of self, and dependent co-arising, we see how wondrous our own hearts and minds are. We see how wonderful our bodies, the branches of violet bamboo, the golden chrysanthemums, the clear stream, and the radiant moon are. Because we imprison ourselves in our suffering, we lose the ability to experience the wonders of life. When we can break through ignorance, we discover the vast realm of peace, joy, liberation, and nirvana. Nirvana is the uprooting of ignorance, greed, and anger. It is the appearance of peace, joy, and freedom. Honored guests, take time to look at a clear stream or a ray of early morning sunshine. Can you experience peace, joy, and freedom? If you are still locked in the prison of sorrow and anxiety, you will be unable to experience the wonders of the universe, which include your own breath, body, and mind. The path I have discovered leads to transcending sorrow and anxiety by looking deeply into their true nature. I have shared this path with many others, and they too have succeeded in discovering it for themselves. Everyone was deeply touched by the Buddha's Dharma talk. The king's heart welled with happiness, as did Queen Gotami's and Yasodhara's. They all wanted to learn more about the methods of looking deeply into the nature of things in order to attain liberation and enlightenment. After the Dharma talk, the king escorted the Buddha and the bhikkhus to the outer gates. The guests all congratulated the king on his son's great attainment. Nagroda Park was soon transformed into a monastery. The ancient fig trees that grew there provided cool shade. Many new bhikkhus were ordained, and many laypersons, including a number of young people of the Sakya clan, took the five precepts. Yasodhara made frequent visits to the Buddha at Nagroda Park, accompanied by the queen and young Rahula. She listened to his Dharma talks, and in private asked him about the relation between practicing the way and performing social service. The Buddha showed her how to observe her breath and practice meditation in order to nourish peace and joy in her own heart. She understood that without peace and joy, she could not truly help others. She learned that by developing deeper understanding, she could deepen her capacity to love. She was happy to discover that she could practice the way of awareness in the very midst of her efforts to serve others. Peace and joy were possible right in the very moments she was working. Means and ends were not two different things. Queen Gotami was also making great progress in the practice. Chapter 36. Lotus Vow. Princess Yasodhara invited the Buddha, Kaludai, Nagasamala, and the Queen to share a meal in her palace. After they finished eating, she invited them to accompany her to a poor hamlet where she worked with children. Rahula joined them also. Yasodhara led them to the old rose apple tree where the Buddha had his first experience of meditation as a young child. The Buddha marveled how it seemed like only yesterday, when in fact 27 years had passed. The tree had grown much bigger over the years. At Yasodhara's request, many poor children gathered by the tree. Yasodhara told the Buddha that the children he had met there so many years ago were now married with families of their own. The children beneath the tree were between the ages of 7 and 12. When they saw the Buddha arrive, playing, and formed two rows for the Buddha to walk between. Yasodhara had showed them beforehand how to greet the Buddha. They placed a special bamboo chair beneath the tree for the Buddha and spread a mat for Gotami, Yasodhara, and the two bhikkhus to sit upon. The Buddha felt happy to sit there. He thought about the days he had spent with the poor children of Uruvela village. He told the children about the buffalo boy, Svasti, and the young girl, Sujata, who gave him milk. He spoke about nourishing a heart of love by deepening one's understanding. And he told them the story about rescuing the swan after his cousin had shot it down. The children listened to all he said with great interest. The Buddha motioned Rahula to sit down in front of him. Then he told all the children a past life story. Long ago, at the foot of the Himalayas, lived a young man named Megha. He was kind and industrious. Though he was without money, he confidently set out for the capital where he hoped to study. He took no more than his walking stick, a hat, a water jug, the clothes he was wearing, and a coat. Along the way, he stopped and worked on farms for rice and sometimes money. By the time he reached the capital of Devapati, he had accumulated 500 rupees. When he entered the city, the people seemed to be preparing for an important celebration. Wondering what the occasion was, he looked around for someone to ask. At that moment, a beautiful young woman walked by him. She was holding a bouquet of half-opened lotus flowers. Megha asked her, "What is the celebration today?" The young woman answered, "You must be a stranger to Devapati, or you would surely know that today the enlightened master Dipankara is arriving. He is said to be like a torch lighting the path for all beings. He is the son of King Archimat, who left in search of the true path and has found it. His path brightens all the world, and so the people have organized this celebration in honor of him." Megha was overjoyed to hear about the presence of an enlightened teacher. He wanted very much to offer something to the teacher and request to become his student. He asked the young woman, "How much did you pay for those lotus flowers?" She looked at Megha and could easily see he was a bright and considerate young man. She answered, "I only paid for 5. The other 2 I picked from the pond at my own house." Megha asked, "How much did you pay for the 5? 500 rupees. Megha asked to buy the 5 lotuses for his 500 rupees in order to offer the flowers to Dipankara. But the woman refused, saying, "I bought these to offer to him myself. I had no intention of selling them to someone else." Megha tried to persuade her, "But you can still offer the 2 you picked from your own pond. Please, let me buy the other 5. I want to offer something to the master. It is a rare and precious opportunity to encounter such a teacher in this life. I want to meet him and even ask to become his student. If you agree to let me buy your 5 lotus flowers, I will be grateful to you for the rest of my life." The woman looked at the ground and did not answer. Megha implored her, "If you let me buy those 5 flowers, I will do anything you ask." The young woman appeared embarrassed. She did not lift her eyes from the ground for a long moment. Finally, she said, "I do not know what connection we have shared in a past life, but I fell in love with you the moment I saw you. I have met many young men, but my heart has never trembled in this way before. I will give you these flowers to offer to the enlightened one. but only if you promise me that in this life and all our future lives, I may be your wife." She said these words hurriedly and was almost out of breath when she finished. Megha did not know what to say. After a moment of silence, he said, "You are very special and most honest. When I saw you, I also felt something special inside. But I am seeking the path of liberation. If I married, I would not be free to follow the path when the right opportunity presented itself." The young woman answered, "Promise that I will be your wife, and I vow that when the time comes for you to seek your path, I will not prevent you from going. On the contrary, I will do everything I can to help you fully achieve your quest." Megha happily accepted her proposal, and together they went to find Master Dipankara. The crowds were so dense that they could barely see him up ahead. But even just catching a glimpse of his face was enough for Megha to know that he was a truly enlightened one. Megha felt a great joy and vowed that he, too, would one day attain such enlightenment. He wanted to get closer to be able to offer Dipankara the flowers, but it was impossible to move through the throngs of people. Not knowing what else to do, he tossed his flowers into the air in the direction of Dipankara. Miraculously, they landed right in the arms of the master. Megha was ecstatic to see how the sincerity of his heart had made itself known. The young woman asked Megha to throw her flowers to the master too. Her two flowers also landed in the master's arms. Dipankara called out, asking the persons who had offered the lotus flowers to present themselves. The crowds parted for Megha and the young woman to pass. Megha clasped the young woman's hand. Together they bowed before Dipankara. The master looked at Megha and said, "I understand the sincerity of your heart. I can see that you have great resolve to follow the spiritual path to attain total enlightenment and to save all beings. Take comfort. One day in a future life you will attain your vow." Then Dipankara looked at the young woman kneeling by Megha's side, and he spoke to her. "You shall be Megha's closest friend in this life and in many lives to come. Remember to keep your promise. You will help your husband to realize his vow." Megha and the young woman were deeply moved by the master's words. They devoted themselves to studying the path of liberation taught by the enlightened one, Dipankara. Children, in that life and in many lives thereafter, Megha and the young woman lived as husband and wife. When the husband needed to leave in order to pursue his spiritual path, his wife helped him in every way she could. She never tried to prevent him. Because of that, he felt the deepest gratitude toward her. At last, he realized his great vow and became a truly enlightened one himself, just as Dipankara had predicted so many lifetimes ago. Children, money and fame are not the most precious things in life. Money and fame can fade very quickly. Understanding and love are the most precious things in life. If you have understanding and love, you will know happiness. Megha and his wife shared happiness for many lives, thanks to their understanding and love. With understanding and love, there is nothing you cannot accomplish. Yasodhara joined her palms and bowed to the Buddha. She was moved to tears. She knew that although he told the story to the children, he meant it especially for her. It was his way of thanking her. Queen Prajapati looked at her. She, too, understood why the Buddha had recounted this story. She placed her hand on her daughter-in-law's shoulder and said to the children, "Do you know who Megha is in this life? He is the Buddha. In this very life, he has become an enlightened one. And do you know who Megha's wife is in this life? She is none other than your own Yasodhara. Thanks to her understanding, Prince Siddhartha was able to follow his path and attain awakening. We should offer thanks to Yasodhara." The children had long loved Yasodhara. They now turned toward her and bowed to her to express all the love in their hearts. The Buddha was deeply touched. Then he stood up and walked slowly back to the monastery with the bhikkhus Kaludai and Nagasamala. Chapter 37. A New Faith. 2 weeks later, King Suddhodana invited the Buddha to a private family meal at the palace. Sariputta was also invited. Queen Gotami, Yasodhara, Nanda, Sundari Nanda, and Rahula were all present. In the close-knit atmosphere of his family, The Buddha showed them how to follow their breath, how to look deeply into their feelings, and how to do walking and sitting meditation. He emphasized how they could transcend the worries, frustrations, and irritations of daily life by practicing mindfulness in daily life. Rahula sat next to Sariputta and placed his small hand in the elder monk's hand. Rahula was very fond of Sariputta. When the time came for the Buddha and Sariputta to return to the monastery, everyone walked with them to the gate. Nanda held the Buddha's bowl as the Buddha joined his palms and bowed farewell to each person. To Nanda's surprise, the Buddha did not take his bowl back. Not knowing what to do, Nanda followed the Buddha back to the monastery, waiting for the right moment to return the bowl. When they arrived at the monastery, the Buddha asked Nanda if he would like to spend a week at the monastery to enjoy a deeper taste of the life of a bhikkhu. Nanda loved and respected his elder brother, and so he agreed. It was also true that Nanda felt drawn to the calm and relaxed life of the bhikkhus he saw around him. When the Buddha asked him at the end of the week if he would like to be ordained and live a bhikkhu's life for several months under the Buddha's guidance, Nanda was most willing. The Buddha asked Sariputta to give Nanda basic instruction and to ordain him as a bhikkhu. The Buddha had first consulted with his father, the king, about allowing Nanda to live as a bhikkhu for a period of time. The king agreed with the Buddha that while Nanda was a well-meaning young man, he lacked the strength of character and determination required of a future king. The Buddha said he could provide Nanda with training that would help Nanda build clarity and resolve. The king was in agreement. Less than a month passed, however, when Nanda began to pine away for his fiancée, the beautiful Janapada Kalyani. He tried to conceal his longing. The Buddha saw clearly into his feelings. One day the Buddha said to Nanda, "If you want to realize your goal, you must first overcome clinging to ordinary emotions. Devote your whole self to your practice and train your mind. Only then can you become an effective leader who can serve others well." The Buddha also asked Sariputta to see that Nanda was no longer sent to do his begging in Kalyani's neighborhood. When Nanda learned of this, he felt a mixture of both resentment and gratitude to the Buddha. He understood that the Buddha could see into his deepest thoughts and needs. Rahula envied his young uncle for being able to live at the monastery. He wanted to be allowed to do the same. But when he asked his mother, she patted his head and said that he must first grow much bigger before he could become a monk. Rahula asked how he could grow faster. She told him to eat well and exercise each day. One day, when she saw the bhikkhus begging close to the palace, Yasodhara turned to Rahula and said, "Why don't you run down and greet the Buddha? Ask him again about your inheritance." Rahula ran downstairs. He loved his mother dearly, but he also loved his father. He had spent all his days with his mother, but had never spent even one whole day with his father. He wished he could be like Nanda and live by the Buddha's side. He ran quickly across the courtyard and out the south gate until he caught up with the Buddha. The Buddha smiled and extended his hand. Though the spring sun was already growing hot, Rahula felt protected by his father's shadow and love. He looked up at his father and said, "It is very cool and refreshing by your side." Yasodhara watched them from the palace balcony. She knew that the Buddha had given Rahula permission to return with him to the monastery for the day. Rahula asked the Buddha, "What is my inheritance?" The Buddha answered, "Come to the monastery and I will transmit it to you." When they returned to the monastery, Sariputta shared his food with Rahula. Rahula ate in silence as he sat between the Buddha and Sariputta. He was so glad to see his young uncle Nanda. The Buddha told Rahula that he could sleep the night in Sariputta's hut. All the bhikkhus were fond of Rahula and treated him so warmly. Rahula wished he could live at the monastery forever. But Sariputta explained to him that if he wanted to stay at the monastery, he would have to become a monk. Rahula clasped Sariputta's hand and asked if he could ask the Buddha to ordain him. The Buddha nodded yes when Rahula asked him, and he instructed Sariputta to ordain the young boy. At first, Sariputta thought the Buddha was jesting. But when he saw how serious the Buddha was, he asked, "But Master, how can one so young become a bhikkhu?" The Buddha answered, "We will allow him to practice in preparation for full vows in the future." Let him take the vows of a novice for now. He can be given the task of chasing away the crows that disturb the bhikkhus during sitting meditation. Sariputta shaved Rahula's head and gave him the three refuges. He taught Rahula four precepts. Do not kill, do not steal, do not speak falsehoods, and do not drink alcohol. He took one of his own robes and cut it down to size for Rahula. He showed Rahula how to wear it and how to hold the bowl for begging. Rahula looked just like a miniature bhikkhu. He slept in Sariputta's hut and went begging with him each day in the small hamlets that bordered the monastery. Although the older bhikkhus ate only one meal a day, Sariputta feared Rahula would lack adequate nutrition for his growing body, and so he let the boy eat an evening meal too. Lay disciples remembered to bring milk and extra food for the little monk. When the news that Rahula had shaved his head and put on a bhikkhu's robe reached the palace, it caused King Suddhodana to become very upset. Both the king and queen missed Rahula terribly. They had expected him to visit the monastery for just a few days and then return to the palace. They hadn't dreamed he might remain in the monastery as a novice. They were lonely without their grandson. Yasodhara felt a mixture of sadness and happiness, though she missed her son intensely. She was comforted to know he was now close to his father after not seeing him for so many years. One afternoon, the king mounted his royal carriage with Queen Gotami and Yasodhara and paid a visit to the monastery. They were met by the Buddha. Nandan Rahula came out to greet them too. In his excitement, Rahula ran to his mother, and Yasodhara embraced her son warmly. Then Rahula hugged both his grandparents. The king bowed to the Buddha and then said rather reproachfully, "I suffered unbelievably when you abandoned home to become a monk. Not long ago, Nanda left me as well. It is too much to bear to lose Rahula. For a family man like myself, the bonds between father and son and grandfather and grandson are very important. The pain I felt when you left was like a knife cutting into my skin. After cutting into my skin, the knife cut into my flesh. After cutting into my flesh, the knife has cut clear to the bone. I beseech you to consider your actions. In the future, you should not allow a child to be ordained unless he has received prior approval by his parents." The Buddha tried to comfort the king by speaking about the truths of impermanence and the absence of a separate self. He reminded him that the daily practice of mindfulness was the only gate by which suffering could be overcome. Nanda and Rahula now had a chance to deeply live such a life. The Buddha encouraged his father to appreciate their good fortune and to continue to practice the way of awareness in daily life in order to find true happiness. The king felt his pain lighten. Gotami and Yasodhara were also comforted and reassured by the Buddha's words. Later that day, the Buddha said to Sariputta, "From now on, we will not receive children into the community of bhikkhus without the approval of their parents. Please note that in our monastic code." Time passed quickly. The Buddha and his Sangha had rested in the kingdom of Sakya for more than 6 months. New ordinations had increased the number of bhikkhus to more than 500. The number of lay disciples was too great to be counted. King Suddhodana also gave the Sangha another place to build a monastery, the former summer palace of Prince Siddhartha, north of the capital, with its cool and spacious gardens. Venerable Sariputta organized a large number of bhikkhus to set up a monastic living there. The presence of this new monastery helped assure a firm foundation for the practice of the way in the Sakya kingdom. The Buddha wished to return to Bamboo Forest in time for the rainy season retreat, as he had promised King Bimbisara and the bhikkhus who had remained there. King Suddhodana invited the Buddha for a last meal before his departure and asked him to give a discourse on the Dharma for the royal family and all members of the Sakya clan. The Buddha used this occasion to speak about applying the way to political life. He said the way could illuminate the realm of politics, assisting those involved in governing the kingdom to bring about social equality and justice. He said, "If you practice the way, you will increase your understanding and compassion and better serve the people. You will find ways to bring about peace and happiness without depending on violence at all. You do not need to kill, torture, or imprison people, or confiscate property. This is not an impossible ideal, but something that can actually be realized." When a politician possesses enough understanding and love, he sees the truth about poverty, misery, and oppression. Such a person can find the means to reform the government in order to reduce the gap between rich and poor and cease the use of force against others. My friends, political leaders and rulers must set an example. Don't live in the lap of luxury because wealth only creates a greater barrier between you and the people. Live a simple, wholesome life, using your time to serve the people rather than pursuing idle pleasures. A leader cannot earn the trust and respect of his people if he does not set a good example. If you love and respect the people, they will love and respect you in return. Rule by virtue differs from rule by law and order. Rule by virtue does not depend on punishment. According to the Way of Awakening, true happiness can only be attained by the path of virtue. King Suddhodana and all those present listened intently to the Buddha. Prince Donodhanaraja, the Buddha's uncle and the fathers of Devadatta and Ananda, said, "Rule by virtue, as you have described it, is truly beautiful. But I believe that you alone possess the character and virtue needed to realize such a path. Why don't you stay in Kapilavatthu and help create a new form of government right here in Sakya Kingdom, which will bring peace, joy, and happiness to all the people?" King Suddhodana added, "I am old. If you agree to remain, I will gladly abdicate the throne in your favor. With your virtue, integrity, and intelligence, I am sure all the people will stand behind you. Before long, our country would prosper as it never has before." The Buddha smiled and did not speak right away. Looking kindly at his father, he said, "Father, I am no longer the son of one family, one clan, or even one country. My family is now all beings. My home is the earth, and my position is that of a monk who depends on the generosity of others. I have chosen this path, not the path of politics. I believe I can best serve all beings in this way." Although Queen Gotami and Yasodhara did not think it befitting to express their own views during this gathering, they were both moved to tears by the Buddha's words. They knew what he said was correct. The Buddha continued speaking to the king and all those present about the five precepts and how to apply them in family life and society. The five precepts were the foundation of a happy family and a peaceful society. He explained each precept carefully and concluded by saying, "If you want the people to be united, you must first obtain their faith and trust. If political leaders practice the five precepts, the people's faith and trust will grow. With that faith and trust, there is nothing the country can't accomplish. Peace, happiness, and social equality will be assured. Create a life based on awareness. The dogmas of the past do not build faith and trust, nor do they encourage equality among the people. Let the Way of Awakening offer a new path and a new faith." The Buddha assured them that although he would soon be departing for Magadha, he would return to Kapilavatthu in the future. The king and all those present were glad to hear that. Chapter 38. Oh, Happiness! From the country of Sakya, the Buddha entered the northern region of Kosala. He was accompanied by 120 bhikkhus, including many young men from noble families. They rested in a park near the city of Anupiya, which was home to the Mala people. Venerable Sariputta was traveling with the Buddha, as were Kaludai, Nanda, and the novice Rahula. Less than a month after the Buddha departed from Kapilavatthu, two young men of the Sakya clan from a very wealthy family also considered leaving home to be ordained as bhikkhus. Their names were Mahanama and Anuruddha. Their family owned three magnificent residences, one for each season. Mahanama wanted to follow several of his friends who had become bhikkhus, but when he learned that his brother had similar thoughts, he changed his mind. There were only two sons in their family. He felt it would be a pity if both became monks. And so Mahanama yielded to his younger brother's desire and granted him the privilege of asking to be ordained. But when Anuruddha asked his mother for her permission, she protested, "My sons are my only happiness in this life. If you become a monk, I could not bear it. Anuruddha reminded her of the many other nobles who had already become bhikkhus. He told her how practicing the way could bring peace and happiness, not only to the monk, but to his family and society. Because Anuruddha listened to many of the Dharma talks the Buddha had given at Nigrodha Park, he was able to speak eloquently about the teaching to his mother. Finally, she said, "Very well, I will let you go, but only on the condition that your good friend Bhadiya decides to become a bhikkhu as well." She was certain that Bhadiya would never consider becoming a bhikkhu. He was also a member of the imperial clan and commanded a high post. His vast responsibilities and his esteemed reputation would be difficult to abandon for the simple life of a monk. But Anuruddha lost no time in seeking out his friend. Bhadiya was the governor of the northern provinces. He had many soldiers under his command. Even his own palace was flanked day and night by armed guards. All day his quarters bustled with the comings and goings of important dignitaries. Bhadiya received Anuruddha as an honored guest. Anuruddha told him, "I want to leave home and become a bhikkhu under the Buddha's guidance, but I cannot, and you are the reason why." Bhadiya laughed. "What do you mean? How have I ever prevented you from becoming a bhikkhu? Why, I would do anything I could to help you fulfill your wish." Anuruddha explained his predicament. He concluded by saying, "You have just said you would do anything you could to help me become a bhikkhu. But the only way is for you to become a bhikkhu yourself." Bhadiya felt caught. It wasn't that he did not also feel drawn to the Buddha and the path of awakening. In fact, he had secretly intended to become a bhikkhu at a later date, though certainly not at present. He said, "In 7 more years I will become a bhikkhu. Wait until then." 7 years is too long to wait. Who knows if I will even be alive then? Bhadiya laughed. "What are you so pessimistic about? But very well, give me 3 years, and I will become a bhikkhu." "Even 3 years is too long." "Very well, 7 months. I need to settle all my household arrangements and hand over my governing duties." Why should one about to abandon home to follow the way require so much time to settle his affairs? A bhikkhu freely leaves all behind in order to follow the path of freedom and liberation. If you take too long, you might change your mind. All right, my friend. Give me 7 days and I will join you." Ecstatic, Anuruddha went home to inform his mother. She had not dreamed that Governor Bhadiya would so easily abandon his prestigious position. Suddenly she sensed the power of the path of liberation, and she felt better about letting her son leave home. Anuruddha persuaded a number of other friends to join him. They were Bhagu, Kimbila, Devadatta, and Ananda. They were all princes of the imperial clan. On the appointed day, they gathered at Devadatta's house and set off in search of the Buddha. They were all of age except Ananda, who was still 18. But Ananda had received his father's permission to follow his older brother, Devadatta. The 6 princes traveled by carriage until they reached a small town close to the Kosala border. They had heard that the Buddha was staying near Anupiya. Anuruddha suggested they get rid of their jewels and ornaments before they crossed the border. They all removed their necklaces, rings, and bangles and wrapped them in a cloak. They agreed to find some poor person to give them to. They noticed a tiny barber shop by the side of the road, which was run by a young man about their own age. He was an attractive fellow, but shabbily dressed. Anuruddha entered his shop and asked him his name. The young barber replied, "Upali." Anuruddha asked Upali if he could direct them across the border. Upali gladly led them there himself. Before they left him, they handed him the cloak containing the precious jewels and ornaments. Anuruddha said, "Upali, we intend to follow the Buddha and live as bhikkhus. We have no more use of these jewels. We would like to give them to you. With these, you will have enough to live in leisure the rest of your days." The princes bid Upali farewell and crossed the border. When the young barber opened up the cloak, the glint of gems and gold dazzled his eyes. He belonged to the lowest caste in society. No one in his family had ever owned so much as an ounce of gold or even a single ring. Now he had an entire cloak full of precious gems. But instead of being happy, he was suddenly seized with panic. He clasped the bundle tightly in his arms All his former feelings of well-being disappeared. He knew there were many people who would kill to get at the contents of the cloak. Upali reflected. The young noblemen who had enjoyed great wealth and power were giving it all up in order to become monks. No doubt they had come to see the dangers and burdens that wealth and fame can bring. Suddenly he too wanted to cast the bundle aside and follow the princes in pursuit of true peace, joy, and liberation. Without a moment's hesitation, he hung the bundle on a nearby branch for the first passerby to claim, and then he too crossed the border. Before long, he caught up with the young nobles. Surprised to see Upali running after them, Devadatta asked, "Upali, why are you running after us? Where's the bundle of gems we gave you?" Upali caught his breath and explained how he had tied the bundle to a tree to be claimed by the first passerby. He said he didn't feel at ease with such riches and wanted to join them in becoming a bhikkhu under the guidance of the Buddha. Devadatta laughed. "You want to become a bhikkhu? But you're a..." Anuruddha cut Devadatta off. "Wonderful, wonderful! We would be pleased if you would join us. The Buddha teaches that the Sangha is like a great sea, and the bhikkhus are like many rivers that flow into that sea, becoming one with it. Though we may be born into different castes, once we join the Sangha, we are all brothers with no distinctions dividing us." Badia extended his hand to Sheikh Upali's. He introduced himself as the former governor of the north provinces of Sakya. He introduced the other princes to Upali, who bowed deeply to each one. Together, the seven young men continued on their way. They reached Anupiya the next day and were told that the Buddha was staying in a forest 2 miles northeast of the city. They made their way to the forest and there met the Buddha. Badia spoke on behalf of the group. The Buddha nodded his acceptance of their request to be ordained. Badia also said, "We would like to ask that Upali be ordained first. We will then bow to Upali as our elder brother in the Dharma, releasing any vestiges of false pride and discrimination that may remain in us." The Buddha ordained Upali first. Because Ananda was only 18, he took the vows of a novice to prepare for full ordination when he reached 20 years of age. Ananda was now the youngest member of the Sangha next to Rahula. Rahula was delighted to see Ananda. 3 days after their ordination, they departed with the Buddha and the other bhikkhus and headed toward Vesali, where they rested 3 days in Mahavana Park. After that, it took them 10 days to reach Bamboo Forest Monastery in Rajagaha. Venerables Kasapa, Moggallana, and Kondana were happy to see the Buddha again, as were all 600 bhikkhus living at Bamboo Forest. King Bimbisara lost no time in paying the Buddha a visit as soon as he learned of his arrival. The atmosphere at Bamboo Forest was happy and warm. The rainy season was fast approaching, and Venerables Kondana and Kasapa were well prepared. This was the third rainy season since the Buddha's awakening. He spent the first at the Deer Park, and the second at Bamboo Forest. Before Badia accepted the governor's post, he had wholeheartedly studied spiritual matters. Now, under Venerable Kasapa's guidance at Bamboo Forest, he devoted heart and mind to his practice, spending almost all his time meditating. He preferred sleeping beneath the trees to sleeping in a hut. One night, while sitting in meditation beneath a tree, he experienced a happiness greater than any he had ever known. He exclaimed, "Oh, happiness! Oh, happiness!" Another bhikkhu sitting nearby heard Badia call out. The next morning, this same bhikkhu reported to the Buddha, "Lord, late last night, while I was sitting in meditation, I heard Bhikkhu Badia suddenly call out, 'Oh, happiness! Oh, happiness!' It appears he misses the wealth and fame he left behind. I thought it best to tell you." The Buddha only nodded. To the noon meal, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk. When he was finished, he asked Bhikkhu Badia to come forward before the community, which also included many lay disciples. The Buddha asked him, "Badia, late last night, while sitting in meditation, did you call out, 'Oh, happiness, oh, happiness'?" Badia joined his palms and answered, "Teacher, last night I did indeed call out those very words." "Can you tell us why?" "Lord, when I was the governor, I lived a life of fame, power, and wealth. Everywhere I went, I was flanked by 4 soldiers for protection. My palace was never without armed guards, day and night. Even so, there was never a moment I felt safe. I was almost constantly filled with fear and anxiety. But now I can walk and sit alone in the deep forest. I know no fear or anxiety. Instead, I feel ease, peace, and joy such as I never felt before. Teacher, living the life of a bhikkhu brings me such great happiness and contentment. I am no longer afraid of anyone or of losing anything. I am as happy as a deer living freely in the forest. Last night, during my meditation, this became so clear to me that I exclaimed, "Oh, happiness, oh, happiness!" Please forgive me for any disturbance it caused you and the other bhikkhus. The Buddha praised Bhadiya before the entire community. "It is wonderful, Bhadiya. You have made great strides on the path of self-contentment and detachment. The peace and joy you feel is the peace and joy to which even the gods aspire." During the rainy season retreat, the Buddha ordained many new bhikkhus, including a talented young man named Mahakasapa. Mahakasapa was the son of the richest man in Mogadha. His father's wealth was exceeded only by the national treasury. Mahakasapa was married to a woman from Vesali named Bhadra Kapilani. They had lived as husband and wife for 12 years, but both longed to follow the spiritual path. Early one morning, Mahakasapa awoke before his wife. Suddenly, he noticed a poisonous snake creeping beside his wife's arm that was hanging over the side of the bed. Mahakasapa did not dare breathe for fear of startling the snake. It slowly crept past Kapilani's arm and out of the room. Mahakasapa woke his wife up and told her what had just taken place. Together, they reflected on the uncertainty and transiency of life. Kapilani urged Mahakasapa to seek a teacher without delay in order to study the way. Because he had heard about the Buddha, he went at once to Bamboo Forest. The moment he saw the Buddha, he understood that the Buddha was his true teacher. The Buddha could easily see that Mahakasapa was a man of rare depth, and he ordained him. Mahakasapa told the Buddha of his wife's longing to become a nun and follow the way, but the Buddha answered that the time was not yet ripe to admit women into the Sangha, and that she would need to wait a little longer. Chapter 39. Waiting for Daybreak. 3 days after the rainy season ended, a young man named Sudatta paid a visit to the Buddha to ask if he would come teach the way of awakening in Kosala. Sudatta was an extremely wealthy merchant. He lived in the capital city, Savati, in the kingdom of Kosala, which was ruled by King Pasenadi. Sudatta was known to his country people as a philanthropist who always set aside a generous portion of his income to share with orphans and the destitute. His charitable efforts gave him much satisfaction and happiness. His people called him Anathapindika, which means the one who cares for the poor and abandoned. Sudatta traveled frequently to Mogadha to buy and sell goods. When in Rajagaha, he stayed with his wife's elder brother, who was also a merchant. His brother-in-law always treated him with the greatest affection, assuring that every detail of his stay was pleasant. He was staying with his brother-in-law at the end of the rainy season. Unusually, his brother-in-law did not cater to many of his needs. Instead, he busily directed family members and servants in preparation for some great feast. Sudatta was surprised to arrive and find the household in the midst of so much activity. He asked if they were preparing to hold a wedding or death anniversary observance. The brother-in-law answered, "Tomorrow I have invited the Buddha and his bhikkhus for a meal." Sudatta asked with some surprise, "Doesn't Buddha mean one who is awake?" "That is right. The Buddha is an awakened person. He is an enlightened master. He is wondrous and radiant. Tomorrow you will have a chance to meet this wonderful person." He could not explain why, but just hearing the name Buddha filled Sudatta with happiness and inspiration. He sat his brother-in-law down and asked to hear more about this enlightened teacher. The brother-in-law explained how, after watching the serene bhikkhus beg in the city, he had gone to hear the Buddha at Bamboo Forest Monastery. He had become one of the Buddha's lay disciples and had even built a number of thatched huts at the monastery as an offering in order to protect the bhikkhus from the sun and rain. He had overseen the building of 60 huts in a single day. Perhaps, Sudatta marveled, it was from a past-life connection, but he felt great love and respect for the Buddha well within his heart. He could not wait until the following noon to meet the Buddha. He spent a restless night, anxiously waiting for daybreak so that he could pay a morning visit to Bamboo Forest Monastery. 3 times he arose from his bed to see if it was dawn yet, but each time the sky was still dark. Unable to sleep any more, he got up anyway. He dressed, slipped into his shoes, and walked out the door. The air was cold and misty. He passed through Sivaka Gate and made his way to Bamboo Forest. By the time he arrived, the first rays of morning sunlight were shining on the bamboo leaves. Though he wanted nothing more than to meet the Buddha, he felt somewhat nervous. To calm himself, he whispered, "Sudatta, do not worry." At that very moment, the Buddha, who was doing walking meditation, passed Sudatta. He stopped and said softly, "Sudatta." Sudatta joined his palms and bowed before the Buddha. They walked to the Buddha's hut, and Sudatta asked the Buddha if he had slept well. The Buddha replied he had. Sudatta told the Buddha how restless a night he had spent, so anxious was he to come and meet the Buddha. He asked the Buddha to teach him the way. The Buddha spoke to Sudatta about understanding and love. Sudatta was filled with great happiness. He prostrated before the Buddha and asked to become a lay disciple. The Buddha accepted him. Sudatta also invited the Buddha and all his bhikkhus to come have a meal the following day at the home of his brother-in-law. The Buddha laughed gently. "My bhikkhus and I have already been invited to eat there today. There is no reason we should expect to eat there tomorrow, too." Sudatta said, "Today my brother-in-law will host you. Tomorrow shall be my offering. I regret I do not have a house of my own in Rajagaha. I entreat you to accept my invitation." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. Overjoyed, Sudatta bowed again, and then quickly returned home to assist his brother-in-law with preparations for that day's meal offering. When Sudatta heard more of the Buddha's teaching at his brother-in-law's home, his happiness knew no bounds. He accompanied the Buddha and the bhikkhus to the gate when the teaching was finished, and at once began to prepare for the following day's meal offering. His brother-in-law joined his efforts with enthusiasm, and even said, "Sudatta, you are still my guest. Why don't you let me take care of all the preparations?" But Sudatta would not hear of it. He insisted on taking care of all the expenses himself, only agreeing to let the family help ready the home and cook some of the dishes. When Sudatta heard more of the Buddha's teaching the next day, his heart opened like a flower. He knelt down and said, "Lord Buddha, the people of Kosala have not yet had an opportunity to welcome you and your Sangha and to learn the way of awakening. Please consider my invitation for you to come to Kosala and spend a period of time. Please show compassion to the people of Kosala." The Buddha agreed to discuss the idea with his senior disciples. He promised to give Sudatta a response within a few days. A few days later, Sudatta visited Bamboo Forest Monastery and received the happy news that the Buddha had decided to accept his invitation. The Buddha asked him if there would be some suitable place near Savatthi where a large community of bhikkhus could dwell. Sudatta assured him that he would find a place and would provide for all the Sangha's needs while they were there. Sudatta also suggested that the Buddha allow Venerable Sariputta to come to Kosala with him first in order to assist in preparations for the Buddha's arrival. The Buddha asked Sariputta whether or not he would like that, and Sariputta replied he would be happy to go. A week later, Sudatta came to Bamboo Forest, where he met Sariputta. They set off together, crossing the Ganga and traveling to Vesali, where they were met by Ambapali, and they rested the night in her mango grove. Sariputta told her that she could expect the Buddha and a large number of bhikkhus to pass through Vesali on their way to Kosala in another 6 months. Ambapali said she would be most happy to offer them food and a place to sleep. She told Sariputta and Sudatta that she was most honored to receive them as guests. She commended the young merchant on his many charitable works and encouraged him in his efforts to have the Buddha bring the teaching to Kosala. After bidding farewell to Ambapali, they headed northwest along the banks of the Achiravati River. Sudatta had never walked such distances before, having always used a carriage in the past. Everywhere they stopped, he announced to people that the Buddha and his Sangha would be traveling through the land, and he asked the people to welcome him. "The Buddha is an awakened master. Prepare to welcome him and his Sangha with jubilation." Kosala was a large and prosperous kingdom, no less powerful. Its southern border was marked by the Ganga, and its northern border brushed the feet of the Himalayas. Sudatta, or Anathapindika, was known to everyone wherever he went. The people trusted what he told them, and they all looked forward to meeting the Buddha and his Sangha. Every morning, when Venerable Sariputta went begging, Sudatta accompanied him to speak to as many people as he could about the Buddha. They reached Savatthi after a month. Sudatta invited Sariputta to his home for a meal and introduced him to his parents and wife. He asked Sariputta to speak about the Dharma, after which his parents and wife asked to take the three refuges and five precepts. Sudatta's wife was a lovely and graceful woman. Her name was Pimnalakana. They had four children, three girls and a boy. The daughters were named Subhadra Elder, Subhadra Younger, and Sumagada. Their son, the youngest child, was named Kala. Sariputta begged every morning in the city and slept in the forest by the banks of the river at night. Sudatta lost no time in searching for a place to host the Buddha and the bhikkhus. Chapter 40. Cover the Land in Gold. Of all the places Sudatta visited, none was more beautiful and peaceful than the park that belonged to Prince Jetta. Sudatta felt sure that if he could acquire this park, it would serve as the perfect place from which the Buddha's way of awakening could be spread to all corners of the kingdom. Sudatta went to see Prince Jetta and found him entertaining a palace official. Sudatta respectfully greeted them both and then expressed directly his hope that the prince would sell him the park to provide a practice center for the Buddha. Prince Jetta was only 20 years old. The park had been a gift the previous year from his father, King Pasenadi. The prince looked at the palace official and then at Sudatta and replied, "My royal father gave me the park. I am very attached to it. I would only part with it if you agreed to cover every square inch of it in gold coins." Prince Jetta was speaking in jest. He certainly wasn't prepared for the young merchant to take him seriously. But Sudatta responded, "Agreed. I will meet your price. Tomorrow I will have the gold brought to the park." Prince Jetta was startled. "But I was only joking. I do not want to sell my park. Don't bother bringing the gold." Sudatta answered with resolve, "Honorable prince, you are a member of the royal family. You must carry out the words you have spoken." Sudatta looked at the palace official drinking tea for support. "Is that not so, your excellency?" The official nodded. He turned to the prince and said, "The merchant Anathapindika speaks the truth. If you hadn't actually quoted a price, it would be different. But you cannot withdraw your offer now." Prince Jetta submitted, but he secretly hoped Sudatta would not be able to meet his price. Sudatta bowed and departed. Early the next morning, Sudatta sent great carts of gold coins and had his servants spread it over the entire park. Prince Jetta was astounded when he saw the great mounds of gold. He understood that this had been no ordinary business agreement. He asked himself why anyone would give so much gold for one park. This Buddha and his Sangha must be truly extraordinary for the young merchant to go to such lengths. The prince asked Sudatta to tell him about the Buddha. Sudatta's eyes shone as he spoke about his teacher, the Dharma and the Sangha. He promised that he would bring Venerable Sariputta to meet the prince the following day. Prince Jetta found himself moved by the things Sudatta told him about the Buddha. He looked up to see that Sudatta's men had already spread gold coins over two-thirds of the forest. Just as a fourth cart was arriving, he held out his hand and stopped them. He said to Sudatta, "That is enough gold. Let the remaining land be my gift. I want to contribute to this beautiful project of yours." Sudatta was pleased to hear this. When he brought Sariputta to meet the prince was impressed by the bhikkhu's peaceful bearing. Together they went to visit the park, which Sudatta had decided to call Jetavana, or Jetta Grove, in honor of the prince. Sudatta suggested to Sariputta that he live at Jetavana to help direct the building of the monastery. He said his family could bring food offerings to Sariputta each day. Together, Sudatta, Sariputta, and the prince discussed building huts, a dharma hall, a meditation hall, and bathrooms. Sudatta expressed a wish to build a three-tiered gate at the forest entrance. Sariputta contributed a number of helpful suggestions regarding setting up the monastery, as he was now very experienced in such matters. They selected an especially cool and tranquil spot to build the Buddha's thatched hut. They oversaw the making of pathways and the digging of wells. The city people soon heard how Sudatta had paved the forest in gold in order to purchase it from the prince. They learned that a monastery was being built to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha, who would soon arrive from Magadha. Sariputta began to give Dharma talks at Jetavana, and the number of people who attended grew daily. Though none of the people had yet met the Buddha, they all felt drawn to his teaching. 4 months later, the monastery was nearly completed. Sariputta set off for Rajagaha in order to lead the Buddha and the bhikkhus back to Jetavana. He met them in the streets of Vesali. Several hundred bhikkhus clad in saffron robes were begging in the streets. He learned that the Buddha and the bhikkhus had arrived in Vesali only a few days previously and were dwelling nearby at Great Forest. The Buddha asked about preparations in Savatthi, and Sariputta recounted how well things were going. The Buddha told Sariputta that he had left Kondana and Uruvelakasapa in charge of the community at Bembu Forest. Of the 500 bhikkhus presently with the Buddha in Vesali, 200 would remain to practice in the vicinity. The remaining 300 would accompany him on the journey to Kosala. The Buddha told Sariputta that Ambapali had invited the entire Sangha for a meal offering the next day. The day after that, they would depart for Savatthi. Ambapali was happy for the chance to offer the Buddha and his bhikkhus a meal in her mango grove. She only regretted that her son Jivaka was unable to attend because of his medical studies. A curious thing happened the day before she was to serve the Buddha and his bhikkhus a meal. On her way home from visiting the Buddha, her carriage was stopped by several princes of the Likavi clan. They were the most powerful and wealthiest lords in Vesali and traveled in handsome, elegant carriages. They asked her where she was going, and she replied she was on her way home to prepare to receive the Buddha and his bhikkhus the following day. The young nobles suggested she forget about the Buddha and invite them instead. The princes said, "Invite us, and we will pay for the meal with 100,000 pieces of gold." They were certain that hosting a monk could not possibly be as amusing or profitable as entertaining them. Ambapali was not interested. She replied, "It is clear you do not know the Buddha, or you would not speak in such a manner. I have already made arrangements to invite the Buddha and his Sangha. Even if you offered me the entire city of Vesali and all the land surrounding it, I would refuse. Now, if you please, let me pass. I have much to do to prepare for tomorrow." Taken aback, the Likavi nobles let her pass. Little did Ambapali know that after their encounter with her, they decided to go and see this teacher who was so highly respected by Ambapali. They left their carriages at the entrance to Great Forest and walked in. The Buddha could tell that these young men possessed many seeds of compassion and wisdom. He invited them to be seated, and he told them about his own life and search for the way. He told them about the path to overcome suffering and realize liberation. He knew they belonged to the same warrior caste he had belonged to, and looking at them, he could see himself as a young man. He spoke to them with warm understanding. Their hearts were opened by the Buddha's words. They felt they could see themselves for the first time. They understood that wealth and power were not enough to bring them true happiness. They knew they had found a path for their lives. They all asked to be accepted as lay disciples. They also asked if they could offer the Buddha and his Sangha a meal the next day. The Buddha said, "We have already been invited by Ambapali for tomorrow." The young nobles smiled, remembering their encounter with Ambapali. "Then allow us to offer you a meal on the following day." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. Ambapali invited all her relations and friends to the mango grove the next day. She invited the Likavi nobles as well to hear the Buddha offer teaching. The day after, the Buddha and 100 bhikkhus ate in the prince's palace. They were served elegant and refined vegetarian dishes that had been prepared with the utmost skill and care. The princes also offered the bhikkhus jackfruit, mangoes, bananas, and rose apples freshly picked from their own orchards. When the meal was finished, the Buddha spoke about dependent co-arising and the Noble Eightfold Path. He touched everyone's heart with the teaching. 12 young nobles asked to be ordained as bhikkhus. The Buddha happily accepted them. They included Otada and Sunakata, two princes who wielded great influence in the Lekavi clan. When the meal and teaching were completed, the Lekavi nobles entreated the Buddha to come dwell in Vesali the following year. They promised to build a monastery in great forest where several hundred bhikkhus could dwell. The Buddha accepted their proposal. Ambapali visited the Buddha early the next morning. She expressed her desire to offer the mango grove to the Buddha and his Sangha. The Buddha accepted her gift. Shortly afterward, Sariputta and 300 bhikkhus headed north for Savatthi.